Gig session number 106.96, Reel One.
Well,
Mr. Martin, Reel One. Could you tell me, first of all, Mr. Martin, when you joined the Navy and why?
I joined the Navy because I signed papers when I was 9 years old to join the Navy. Which is now illegal, of course. Because I went to Greenwich School, because I was allowed to go there, because my father was in the Navy.
So you were educated at Greenwich School?
Yeah, at Greenwich School. This is not the officer's place. This is the old Greenwich School below the observatory, between the officer's place and the observatory. That's on the north side of the road.
Near where the Maritime Museum is now?
Is actually where the place where the Maritime Museum is.
That used to be Greenwich School?
That was Greenwich School.
What kind of an education did you get there?
Fair education. Although I went really in a lower class, I think, than I was entitled to go. I've got some books here I could show you.
No, we weren't
looking
I'll show
you afterwards.
So you thought of nothing else except going into the Navy?
That's it.
And where did you get your basic training?
Well, I did a year in Greenwich School, and then there was a gentleman from Australia who left a lot of money because he said he was indebted to the Navy, and he left it to build a new maritime school, and it was built at Holbrook. And after I'd been there a year, Holbrook School in Suffolk. And after I'd been at Greenwich a year, I was joined there at the age of 12, the new school opened at Holbrook, so we're all moved to Holbrook School. And I stayed there till I was 15 and a half, and then I went to Shotley as a signal boy.
Where's Shotley?
Shotley is on the peninsula between the River Stour and Orwell, on the very tip towards Felixstowe.
Can you describe what your training was like at Shotley?
Yes, it was 15 months as a signal boy training. Quite a tough life. Plenty of discipline.
So a signal boy is just a boy who's training to be a signaller?
That's it, yes.
How is it tough? Can you describe how?
Well, you had the bare necessities for your bed clothes, just one blanket you're allowed, and a pillow, and never had sheets then in those days. But you had extra blanket, of course, and the actual life was very Spartan, you know. You had two instructors. One was the visual signals, as I was, and the other one, telegraphist instructor. Mostly either petty officer or chief in charge. And you had to do seamanship as well, a certain amount of seamanship, and learn to sail boats and all that kind of thing. And climb the mast, of course, which is a national monument, I believe, the mast there, isn't it, in Shotley.
How did the NCOs treat you there?
Well, there's plenty of parade drill and all that kind of thing, and if you fell out of step with the, you were what they put on, what they call Shotley routine, which you had to double everywhere and made life very uncomfortable for you for quite a long while.
Were you ever punished yourself?
No.
So this was HMS Ganges, wasn't it?
HMS Ganges, and of course, I used to get caned for smoking and all that kind of thing. And I used to get caned for various offences.
Were you treated brutally or fairly?
No, I was quite fair, really.
Now, I think that once you actually joined your ships, that you were with the Ramillies.
Yeah, the Ramillies was one of the old battleships from the war, 15-inch guns.
What would she like to serve on?
Quite good, actually. I enjoyed myself on there. Of course, you didn't have a lot of time to yourself in the signal branch. Always on watch. Up at crack of dawn in the morning, about 6 o'clock. And we'd be up there scrubbing the flag deck in the morning before 7, and you'd be on watch either till 8 o'clock, or if you had the forenoon watch, you'd go off at 7 and come up at 8 o'clock, and you'd be on watch practically all day. Sometimes you just had about 10 minutes for your dinner. You go down to shifts for meals.
Was it comfortable aboard ship?
Well, you just had the hammock to sleep in. And actually, our mess on there didn't seem anybody in charge of the communications mess deck. It was just sort of a bit chaotic. We never had enough cutlery to go round and all that kind of thing.
Now, on Ramillies, I think you were serving off the Spanish coast during the Civil War there.
Oh, yes.
What are your memories of that?
Well, there's a lot of atrocities. I remember women and children jumping over the sides of these big ships into the water and being machine gunned as they went down by the Spanish warships. A lot of atrocities there. And
what kind of ships were they jumping off?
Off merchant ships. And we picked up a lot of people at sea who were starving.
Which side did the Spanish ships who were machine gunning them belong to? Did you know?
Well, they were Franco's people, under the Spanish flag. That's all I knew.
Why were they jumping off the merchant ships?
Well, they were just held up for the gunships, and they were trying to escape.
Where was this that you saw?
That was during the blockade. We used to be patrolling outside the 3-mile limit.
Do you remember which particular port it was at?
I wouldn't be quite sure at this moment, no.
Oh, which year?
It was about 38, I think it was. 1938. I've got some cuttings in my book about that. We took a lot of people off ships that had been at sea quite a while. We took them to La Police and La Rochelle and put them ashore. We sometimes had a hangar full of people we picked up. One lot had terrific skin burns. The boiler blew up on board this small boat. They're all crying out for water. Had no water left on board or anything.
These are Spaniards, were they?
Spaniards, yeah, we picked up quite a lot. at sea, you know, who'd gone away in these open boats and on various craft. One particular craft I remember more than others, and that was the Emil Robin, called the Emil Robin. That was an old lifeboat, an old ship's lifeboat. We took that on board and kept it, the whole lifeboat. We used to use that.
So were they escaping from the northern coast of Spain?
Yeah, the Mediterranean side.
The eastern coast?
Yeah.
But you took them to La Rochelle?
Yeah.
In France?
Yeah.
And so the people who'd been burnt had been scalded by an accident?
Yes, it? Yes. And I remember I asked the ship's company to give any clothing we could so we could to put on. And I gave all my sports shirts and shorts for them to wear. They're all going around dressed half a sailor now.
Can you remember the outbreak of war?
Yes, very well. We were in Malta at the time, the second destroyer flotilla were.
And how was it announced to you that we were at war with Germany?
Well, we just said we're at war.
Who told you?
I don't remember exactly now who said, but I suppose we, being in a signal branch, we were the first to know.
Did it take you by surprise?
No, I don't think so, no. We were sort of expecting it, I think, to happen.
Which ship were you serving on at the time?
I was on the Hostile then.
Can you tell me what the Hostile was like to serve on?
Yeah, it was quite a happy ship, you know, happy ship's company.
Who was the captain?
Captain Wright.
Did you see much of him?
Yes, because being a signalman, he was in contact with him on the bridge quite a lot. When you were on watch on your own, you'd be on watch on the bridge, and the captain was on the bridge quite a lot. In it.
What kind of a chap was he?
He's quite a nice chap, really. Yeah, we used to say a lot.
How did serving on a destroyer compare with the Remleys?
No, entirely different.
In what way?
You're in close contact with everybody there, and there's only a small signal staff. And everything is much smaller and compact. The flag deck is minute, and everything is, the flags are smaller and the lamps are smaller and everything else.
Which did you prefer?
I prefer the destroyers best. It's a much better life on a small boat.
For what reason?
Well, it's more friendly. Everybody's more in contact with each other and more friendly with each other than on a big ship. On a big ship, everybody seems to be remote, you know, and strange. You see, on a big ship, on a battleship, you'd have over 1,000 in the crew.
So it was more chummy on a...
Yes, more ship. Chummy, yes, on a smaller ship.
Can you tell me about your own involvement in the Norway campaign, starting at the beginning and going right through stage by stage, telling me in detail what you remember, please?
Yes, I could start with leaving Scapa Flow. When we left Scapa Flow, we got hung up on the boom in the gate. We was there all night.
How did that come about?
I got the screws caught in the wires. And the captain was a bit wild about that, and the smoke was coming over the bridge, and we we asked, the signalman asked, could we have permission to keep watch from the flag deck, which is a bit lower? And he said, no, you can't do that. You'll have to stay up on the bridge. And the smoke, as we were caught in the boom, was coming directly from the funnel, directly onto the bridge, and nearly choking us. And we had to stop there all night, and I was on watch for 4 hours. I'm not sure what I had the first watch, and I had to be on watch till midnight, and then at 4 o'clock, or what I had the middle watch, but I think I had the first watch. And then I had to come on watch again at 4. The first watch is from 8 in the evening till midnight. And was glad to get down off free from the boom, because we nearly choked to death by the time we finished. Anyway, we eventually got away, and we caught up with the second destroyer flotilla, and there was a lot of signals going back and forwards about refueling. I think we were supposed to meet with some cruisers to get some fuel on board. Anyway, it all fell by the board, and the Captain D said, do you think you should stay with it and go in with us? And he said, yes, we'll. I think we'll be all right. And we, as we were cruising up to Narvik, Captain D was making a lot of signals about landing parties. I expect you've heard this from other people, have you? And organising so many from each ship to be this, that and the other, and who was going to form all these people to go ashore in these parties when they got through into Narvik. And it was very bad weather conditions as regard visibility. The snow was coming down in great flakes, and I was on watch. And I got a kaya broom and just kept sweeping the bridge free of snow, because it was piling in right thick. And every time I took my gloves off to write a signal, they were getting frozen. When I put my gloves on again, it was where you get pins and needles, you know, as the circulation was coming back in. It was sweeping away all the snow, and I had 4 balaclava helmets on. The ears were still cold. And when we got to this fjord, we couldn't see anything, and we had no radar, so they said that we'd find a way in with Asdix. And as it was a fjord, with deep water and not a lot of room to go in, we were taking soundings from the sides as we went in to find out where we were, because the visibility was practically nil with the snow. Anyway, we got through all right, and by daybreak, the snow had cleared away, and we went steaming up, and Captain D gave the order to fire torpedoes, and we all went in and fired the torpedoes at all these ships alongside the quay. And there was quite a lot of havoc in there.
What kind of ships? Merchant ships?
All the merchant ships, yes. They were all merchant ships in there getting the iron ore for German armaments. And directly after this happened, when everybody sort of woke up to what was happening ashore, all hell broke loose, and they started firing torpedoes into the Sound. And we'd fired all our torpedoes bar two. They got jammed in the tubes. We couldn't get rid of them. And directly after that, there was all these Bofors guns with the tracers opened fire up on the hills. It was quite high hills all the way around. And all these tracers were coming and it appeared to be coming straight at you. And when they eventually come, you could see all these just going over the tops of our heads. And then the destroyers came in. I don't know the exact name of the class of German destroyers they were, but they had more guns than us, and they were larger guns. They were 5.5s. We had 4.7s. And their guns were 5.5 inch. And there was one shell went between the mast and the rangefinder and didn't hit anything. And another shell hit us forward in the paint locker. The paint locker's right forward because all the inflammables and paint are kept right in the forward in the ship, right in the bows. And that's all the trouble that we got.
So that started a fire on board, did it?
Yeah. They soon put that out. And Captain D, he got badly hit. And the Hunter, she badly hit, and her steering gear got jammed. And the Hunter rammed the Hardy right in the stern. And it was pushing her along. Couldn't avoid that.
Did you see all this?
I saw it all, yeah. And the Hotspur, she was very badly damaged. She was like a pepper pot, she was. And
we should say Captain D was aboard the Hardy.
Yeah. Captain Warburton Lee was on the Hardy. And I was sending all these signals through on radio in plain language. And we he gave the order to make smoke. We was going round in a circle and going back into the smoke screen. And he gave the order to hoist a battle ensign, which I thought was a bit strange because his flag was a big, dense cloud of black smoke, which we made, and he was going along through this with his battle ensign sticking out the top. This is just before he got into trouble.
So that was giving his position away?
Yeah, and he gave the order, hoist the battle ensign. So I grabbed hold of the battle ensign to go and hoist it. And there was another signalman on board, Smithy, and he said, never on your life, you ain't going to hoist that. He stopped me. So he never did hoist a battle ensign.
He stopped you because of the danger?
Yeah, he said, no, that's not to be done.
What rank did Smith have?
He was just a signalman. And he was a lot older than me.
What does a battle ensign look like?
Just a big ensign. Just a big ensign that they put at the foremost.
The white...
When you go into battle.
The white ensign.
The white ensign, yeah. So when we got clear of all this smoke and that, we were coming away, and some more destroyers came out to block our way out. And we went past them, firing all the way. And then when we got to further out, there was a big merchant ship coming in, big German ship coming in. It was an ammunition ship. I can't recall the name of it at the moment. And Captain Wright stopped it, and we sent a boarding party on board with a demolition party, and they blew it up. It was a terrific explosion, and you can imagine how much, what it was like with an ammunition ship going up sky high. And then directly after that, the Havoc, this is when the Havoc was badly damaged, and it was heeling right over on its side. And he ordered us back, and
who ordered you back?
Captain Wright ordered us and another ship back to put a smoke screen round the Hotspur.
Round the Hotspur?
Yeah, because she was badly damaged and healing over.
You said the Havoc.
Did I? Oh, well, that's the Hotspur. And we rushed back, put a smoke screen round it, and took it away. And we went into Claxwick the Fjord and dropped anchor in there. And when we got there, we took stock. We had ten tons of oil fuel left. The canteen was completely empty except for bars of soap. And we had no provisions or hardtack left on in the ship. Nothing whatsoever to eat. So we couldn't have gone anywhere because I'd never had enough fuel to go anywhere. We'd fired all around.